And this is actually the third time going through Genesis. But this particular time has been a special time as we are looking more closely at the parallels, because the Bible tells us to, how this is an example for us. Because if we were just reading about history and names and dates and things that happened in the past, what really does that mean? Except that it has a great application for us. In this particular chapter, it follows chapter 45, which was a picture of the day of revelation when Joseph revealed himself to his brothers. After that long period of time where their consciences were being awakened, it's a type of coming into awareness of God. Joseph now reveals himself to his brothers. And the same shock, if you think about it, the same shock that his brothers had when they discovered this powerful ruler that had absolute control of their lives was none other than their brother Joseph. They were, speechless. They couldn't say anything. They were dismayed. They were amazed. There was nothing that was coming to their mind. That's the same shock when we discover that the God who created all things has sent his Son to die in our place, and that he actually invites us into a relationship. And listen, the Bible calls Jesus our brother. And that's kind of a shock when you really think about it. The one that you were afraid of, the one that was, you know, terrifying, the all-powerful one that has your very life in his hands is now your brother. That's kind of the experience. And of course, then he commissions them to go back, get the Father, and then they're going to come back. And they've got this whole picture of just travel light. You know, don't worry about your stuff there. And this is the message that we need to get in our hearts and minds, traveling light in this pilgrimage. Well, now chapter 46 records the pilgrimage. They're now going to go on a pilgrimage in Egypt for 430 years. And it's represented in a way by Jacob coming up into the land. And Joseph introduces him to the Pharaoh, and he blesses the Pharaoh. And then they settle in the land of Goshen, where they will be until eventually the powers that be change in Egypt and it becomes a slavery rather than a blessing. But even the slavery, their great nation is formed, and eventually they'll come out, and we will follow up on that. But let's take a look a little more closely how this relationship to us fits. The first verse of chapter 46 says, "So Israel took his journey." Remember, he went from Jacob to Israel. Now, God still calls him Jacob because I think God knows. He sees him as he really is, but Israel is starting to really grow by faith. So his name is not Jacob anymore, but Israel. So Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father, Isaac. Beersheba was the very southernmost border of Israel. Dan was the highest, and oftentimes in the Bible you'll see the God describing Israel from Dan to Beersheba. It's kind of like the northernmost and the southernmost border. Well, Jacob had never been beyond that southernmost border. In fact, beyond Beersheba, just wilderness, desert, until you get to the pagan land of Egypt. Now think about this. He'd never been there. He's called now to move everything there, leave nothing behind. He's an old man, 130 at the time. You know how old people hate change. They don't like change. I've noticed as we've grown even as a church, you know, every time we make a change, it's like, yep, 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 yep. Everybody complains about anything that we change. Why did you do this? I like the old thing. Why did we do this thing? You know, stop it already. But here's Jacob. Now picture what he's like. Young people are like, hey, something new, adventure, let's go for it. I remember when I was young, left college, went out to California, it was nothing. But as you get older, you get a little more set in your ways. And Egypt is a very old and very advanced civilization, prosperous, superior in mathematics and architecture and astronomy and agriculture and medicine. I mean, they are the technologically advanced society, but they're full of idols. They have gods for everything. There's gods of the Nile, gods of the land, gods, the grain god, Anubis, the guardian of the field, Horus, the bird god. You've got all of these gods, and of course the most significant god of all, Ra, the sun god, was revered, and he literally, they believe, embodied the Pharaoh. So the Pharaoh was like a living, walking god. What's going to happen to Jacob and his family? What's going to happen to the nation of Israel there? Because they're so close now to the world. Isn't that dangerous? Isn't that difficult? How will they keep separate? Abraham, after all, stumbled there, was afraid of the Pharaoh and lied about his wife, saying that she was his sister. And then, of course, Isaac did the same thing. Jacob was a little bit nervous, I'm sure. And you know what? Listen, I think when Jacob is facing this, he goes to Beersheba before he starts that journey in the wilderness into Egypt. He builds an altar to the same place where his father Isaac had in Beersheba. And he seeks the Lord. Essentially, what is he doing? You see, it seems like a no-brainer. Joseph, your son is alive. Go there. But what I love about Israel now is that he's got a healthy fear that I think every one of us need to have. A healthy fear of ourselves, a healthy fear of, you know, what we might get into left to ourselves. In fact, it's not unlike a fear that I had my very first summer vacation as a Christian believer. I'd become a Christian my first term at the university. It was the winter time, the middle of the winter. And only 4 or 5 months later, I'm facing my very first summer vacation. And you know what? I'm terrified. I'd grown a lot, but all I could think of, all I could envision is going back to my hometown and my friends call me up, hey, come on, we're going partying. And I've got nobody that I know, a Christian there. I don't know anybody. Here I'm in a campus group. I'm protected. We're having a great fellowship. I'm learning the Bible. Going back to my hometown, I was terrified. And I remember the leader of the campus group was announcing these different opportunities for the summer, various projects, various Bible schools. And I mean, I couldn't get up to the front fast enough. I'm signing up. Doesn't matter what it costs, I'm doing it. I was afraid of myself. And you know what? I think the difference is, and I shared with you this not long ago when I was in California, I met a man who was struggling with meth. And he thought he had it under control. And I said, you know, the only difference between you and me is I'm much more afraid of myself than you are of yourself. So you have to have a healthy fear of what you're capable of. Don't think you're above it. Don't think, oh, I would never do that. As soon as it comes out of your mouth, you're going to stumble and fall because you stand not by your own strength. And so Jacob has a healthy fear, and I think it's wise. So even though it appears providentially, it's a no-brainer, go to Egypt, Jacob builds an altar, and he calls on the name of the Lord. And I think this is significant. An altar represents a place of sacrifice. In our case, the altar represents what Jesus did for us. It's not your sacrifice he's looking for. But it does also represent a place where you give thanks and you acknowledge what God has done. And it also represents a place where you are seeking God. And I think this is what Jacob is doing more than ever. He's seeking the Lord. I just want to confirm. I want to make sure. I don't want to assume. And you know, I shared with the elders yesterday as we had a meeting together and prayed and just seeking the Lord and talking about various things the Lord is doing here. I said, guys, you know what? There's a lot of things on the table here for this summer. I'm very afraid that we get into this place where we think, oh, you know what? God blessed so much last year. Of course it's going to be a blessing this year. God help us. No, and I think that there's no yawning here with Jacob. He's calling on the name of the Lord. And we really need to pray. We can't assume, and not just for the church, but for our own lives. And I don't want to just continue to do something because annually we do it every year. I want to, Lord, is this your will? Do you want us to do it this year? And if we don't, then we'll do something else. We'll see. Well, whatever you want, because I want to be where the Lord is. And I think that's where Jacob is at this point. Well, God answers him. It says in verse 2, God spoke to Israel in the vision of the night, the visions of the night, and said, Jacob, Jacob. I like that. Israel calls him the name of the Lord, and the Lord calls him Jacob. And he says, here I am. I love those words, here I am. Oh, I wish that every one of us would say that from the heart. Here I am. I'm yours, God. And he said, I am God, the God of your father. Now, God actually speaks to him personally. He answers Jacob personally. There's only 3 other times in the Bible where God actually uses the name of the person in this double exclamation. Abraham, Abraham, he said. Samuel, Samuel, he said. Saul, Saul. And now Jacob, Jacob. But listen. Has he called you? You know, this isn't just like dead words on a page. People like to talk about in the emergent church, you know, well, these are just dead words. You know, you got to have a personal, interpersonal experience with God. I agree. But that will never go farther than the depth of this word. In other words, there's something deep. Jesus said when he spoke to his disciples, my words are spirit and their life. There's a personal dimension there. but that's wrapped up in this relationship with the Lord. And it should be one of those things where you know when you're praying, it's not just you're giving a soliloquy, you're not just talking to the wind, you're dialoguing, you're communing with God. And how He does that? Well, Jesus said, you don't see the wind, but you see the effects of the wind, and you don't see the Spirit, but you see the effect of it. There's not an audible voice that you're going to hear. You're not going to have angels sit on the edge of your bed and explain things to you. The Lord has given you His Word, but you know in your spirit there's something deeper happening, and you know He is saying, John, John, Susan, Susan, speaking to you personally. And He reaffirms the covenant. He says, do not fear to go down to Egypt, verse 3, for I will make of you a great nation there. Now, He'd already promised that to Abraham. He promised that to Isaac. Now He's promising it to Jacob, that you're going to be a great nation. Now, we have a great covenant, too, with the Lord. We have promises of every spiritual blessing in the heavenly places. Wonderful experience if we really believe that and know that our position in Christ, the Bible calls us in Revelation 5, kings and priests unto the Father. Now listen, then He promises Him what I think is the most significant. He says, verse 4, and I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also surely bring you up again, and Joseph will put his hand on your eyes. What I hear there is, I will go with you. You know what? This is what I'm desiring. This is the biggie. It doesn't matter where the Lord calls me, as long as He's with me. And that should be your heart. Lord, whatever you want, as long as you go before me. If you don't go before me, if you're not with me, don't send me. And I think that's wise. Some of my friends getting trained for ministry back in California, some were called to Hawaii. And they went to Hawaii. Some were called to Australia. Some to New Zealand. Some to Chile. I was called to New Jersey. Now, why are you laughing? I find that fascinating. Don't you like this place? Listen, I absolutely love New Jersey because this is where the Lord's called me. I can't imagine myself anywhere else except in this northeast corridor because I believe that for the season He has me here, His pleasure is here, and this is where I want to be more than any place else. In fact, I talked to my brothers who are in Hawaii, and you know, it's a challenge in Hawaii. Everybody gets to Hawaii, and who wants to serve? You know, come on, let's go surf. You know, it's hard to find people to volunteer for anything there. But you know what? Here, listen, you're here for a season, and that season may be for you to use your gifts and get equipped and to get empowered by the Lord that He might use you in whatever field you're in. Maybe He'll call some of you to be in the mission field, call some of you to serve over here or there. But no matter where it is, how daunting it is, maybe you won't go, but you might get supportive of the work. You may not be called to Africa, but I'll tell you what, I know Eric Caesar and his wife are called to Africa, and I can't wait to get them over again. And you know, I know he struggles with the whole fundraising thing, you know, because it's just not him. But man, he's doing a work over there. God is doing an amazing work. And we're on the radio there in Kenya, and we're experiencing so many great responses. Things are stirring because what's different about the work in Africa today now is that people are getting grounded in the Word, where before it has been just a lot of evangelism and excitement, but now they're getting grounded. You know, you may not be able to go, but you can support someone who goes. You may not be able to have your kids in the school, but you could support somebody that actually can't afford it, but really, really wants that for their children. This is all a part of whatever the season is. Now, no matter what you face, how daunting it is, imagine Jacob facing this incredible move. He needs to hear from God, I'm with you. And you know, the big decisions we've made in this fellowship from the very beginning, we've really sought the Lord, and He has smiled on a number of things as a result of us being where He wants us. You know, I remember when we first came to this building, it was daunting. And we were only looking at one-tenth of it, one little bay. It was like, oh, this is huge. What are we going to do with this place? That was a big step. It was a big step of faith. We could afford it, but still, you know, it's like we didn't quite need all that space for the midweek in the offices. We were still meeting in the school over there in Old Bridge. But you know what? Amazing. Now I look, this building, it's way too small for us. We've got to squeeze in 4 services. We've got the building next door, and we've got a couple buildings down. We still need more space for this and that. It's amazing what God has done. I think of the decision to go on the radio, taking our program, our messages here, Bridging the Gap. We went on MCA for 10 years. That was an expensive adventure. I'm still running into people, though I've been off the station there for a number of years, I'm still running into people that remember listening almost every day. I'm humbled by that. The Word of God into their homes. And then the Lord opened up the other door for the radio station. And each step, these were crazy. And then doing the school, the elementary school. I mean, I was told by a number of people, you know, that schools, it's just not going to work. They're all going down in New Jersey. It's not working. Christian schools are struggling. But look what God has done. Each year, it's growing. Even in this economy. I'm humbled by this. The high school, even more crazy. What are we doing? But the Lord is faithful. And I think of Jacob, he prayed. And whatever you're facing, whatever you may be on the verge of some difficult choice or decision in your life, listen, you pray. You might feel like you're hedged in and providentially this is the only thing that makes sense. I mean, this move only makes sense. I mean, I'm getting closer to family or my job is moving me here and it just makes sense. Everything might seem to make sense to you. But I want to encourage you, pray. Pray. Now we come to verse 5 of chapter 46. And it says that Jacob arose from Beersheba. And the sons of Israel carried their father Jacob and their little ones and their wives in the carts which Pharaoh had sent to carry him. And they took their livestock, their goods, which they had acquired in the land of Canaan, and went to Egypt, and Jacob and all his descendants with him, his sons' sons, his daughters and his sons' daughters, all his descendants he brought with him to Egypt. And then from verse 8 through verse 27, it basically lists the heads of the families. 70 heads of families in all, representing probably quite a few more people. But these were the sons of Jacob and their sons. So it was his sons and his grandsons. And all totaled, when you total them all up, it comes to 70. A list of names. Now you've come across already in Genesis quite a few lists of names. Chapter 4, chapter 5, 10, 11, 36. All the names, some 200 names so far if you total them all up. And now here's another 70 names. So we'll be testing you on them a little bit later. We have a hard time remembering names, don't we? We have a hard time remembering names of people we know, people that we've met. But a name is such an amazing thing. It's your indicator. It's you. It's who you are to people. It's the peg of truth that you are. This is your name. This is who you are. And I think of how the Lord remembers your name. He calls Jacob by name. He knows you by name. And I think it's an amazing thing that God records these names. More than that, this becomes a very important way. You know, a lot of times you read through all these genealogies and you wonder, what's the point? It's the least interesting part of the Bible by far, we think. And I think for the most part, yeah, as far as reading, yeah, kind of boring. You can't even pronounce them, let alone get, you know, just reading them, even if you could pronounce them. What's the point? You know, the interesting thing is, the Bible is unique in that it does list so many names and people groups and civilizations and geographical places and all these things. What that does, as a religious book, it's a unique situation because it makes the Bible testable. That is, a lot of religious books just will give forth a philosophy or a belief system, but how do you know whether it's true or not? How can you test it? It's just, it is, you either believe it or you don't believe it. Most people look at the Bible like that. Well, you either believe it or you don't. But listen, isn't there something else? Didn't God want you to have a little more confidence that he wrote this book? We know that prophecy is one of those things. He certainly signed his name to it because no one could know the end from the beginning like he does. But here's another way to test. The Bible lists all these people, groups, names, civilizations, all of these things. You can go and you can find them in the records. You can dig them up. The archaeologist Spade has uncovered so much of what the Bible has said. And it simply is one of those things is the more they dig, the more they realize how accurate the Bible is, and the more they actually use the Bible to guide them. If the Bible says there's a city in between this city and that city, and they haven't discovered it, and the critics say, ha, see, the Bible's wrong. Those who know the Bible go, no, let's go find it. It's there. And they find it. Over and over and over again throughout Israel. This is how they've discovered many of the cities there, just by going as the Bible as a guidebook. You know, the interesting thing is if you compare the Bible to the Book of Mormon, for example, the Book of Mormon also is one of those unique things, mentions people groups and people and geographical locations and civilizations and all of these things. There's only one difference. Not one of those things in the Book of Mormon has ever been found. And the poor Mormon archaeologists, they've got their work cut out for them, because essentially all they can do is say, well, we believe it's there, we just haven't found it yet. That's what makes the Bible so amazing, and so it becomes testable. Now, the question is, when you have these lists of names, however, you have a list here and the same list over in Numbers 26 and 1 Chronicles 2 through 8, you can compare them, and of course that creates what some people say is kind of contradict. There's some contradictions there, because there's names that are different. This one says he had 10 sons. This one says he has 3 sons. That's a contradiction. Well, it would be if people would just dig a little deeper, they find it's not. It would be on the surface. One record says Joseph has 3 sons, and another one says he has 10 sons. There's a problem. Except for one thing. We only have a few words. We have son, and then we have grandson, great-grandson. In Hebrew, there's only one word, son. So you could call the Messiah the son of David. Well, there were lots of people in between David and Jesus. But there's only one word. Son, the word applies to grandson, great-grandson. And so you have this, and sometimes it creates extra names in the record, and you don't know whether, well, those must be grandsons then. And that becomes a problem. Sometimes the spelling of the name is a little bit different. But here, the real point of this is this. There's only 70 heads of families going into Egypt. When God, if you remember in Genesis where God promised to Abraham, your descendants will be like the stars of the sky, like the sand of the seashore, that will be innumerable. You can't even number them. That was 215 years ago. 215 years and only 70 families. Now, granted, Abraham got a late start. He was 100 when he had, nearly 100 when he had Isaac. Isaac was 60 when he had Jacob and Esau. So you can see it seems to be a very slow start, certainly by any other standards, 215 years. I mean, our nation at 215 years, look at the numbers that have multiplied. So this is very slow in comparison. But he was told he'd be a father of many nations. But listen, God is not in a hurry. He's laying a foundation. Just like in your own life, you can be very impatient with how God is working in you. You want Him to move faster. You want to know more. You want to grow more. But it seems so slow. But God's laying a foundation. And also, listen, if you became a Christian and immediately had everything handed to you, what happens to us? Sometimes we get very lazy spiritually. God is digging us deep in Him. And sometimes it does not appear that it's working. Just like for Jacob, it does not appear this promise is coming to fruition. But he does say, I'm going to make you a great nation down there in Egypt. And certainly by the time they come out 430 years later, there's 2.5 million of them. 600,000 men just within the ages of 20 and 50, the fighting men of the army, representing some 2.5 million people. God multiplies them, as he said. Now jump down to verse 28, and it says, then he sent Judah before him to Joseph to point out before him the way to Goshen. So Jacob sent on Judah, go find out where we're supposed to go, lead this whole troop. And they came to the land of Goshen. Joseph then made ready his chariot and went up to Goshen to meet his father Israel. And he presented himself to him. This must have been some meeting. Fell on his neck and wept on his neck a good while. I can't even, in my mind's eye, the best opportunity, I can't picture this, how powerful this must have been. For 22 years, there was a sword that cut the heart of Jacob, thinking his son, Joseph, was dead. To discover he's alive and that he's raised up as the most powerful leader in Egypt, it's overwhelming. Then to see him with your face, can you imagine that reunion? Can you just fathom that for a moment? I mean, think about it as a parent, how important it is for you, for your children to be successful and to do well and to be healthy, and how much it hurts you as a parent. You cannot see your kids suffer without you suffering. Even if they're absolute rebellious and they hate you and you see them in pain, it still breaks your heart. Because this is how God made us. And I can only imagine. And I think as a parent, what decisions do we make for our children so that we can give them a better future? We discipline them in love. We don't indulge them too much. because it's damaging to them. I'm amazed how many parents go down the road of making some real bad decisions in regard to that. You know, they've got adult children living with them, paying no rent, paying for their car insurance. What, are you nuts? You say, well, Pastor Loy, that's a little personal. And, you know, it's hard to make it in this state. Well, yeah, and you know what? You're going to effectively handicap them from being able to make it ever on their own then. It's so hard to see your kids go through tough times and they've got to work hard and provide for themselves when they get adults. But listen, you do not want to rob them of the opportunity to become an adult. And you will. And I think in many ways, when you think about how God raises us, does He just give you whatever you want? Don't you wish? But you really wouldn't want that. You know, there's something better with trusting the Lord's way. And you know, as a young person, you learn how to work hard and provide for yourself. I'm always reminded of that one wealthy client a friend of mine has, and he could well afford to pay for his kids' way through college. And you know, this friend of mine had a number of clients, all wealthy, and all of their kids are messed up, on drugs, screwed up, you know, dropped out of college. Except for this one family, it was quite notable, he said, because this father said to his children, I'm not going to pay a penny for you to go through college. You're going to work your way on your own and make it on your own. I don't want to rob you of the ability to make it as a man, he said to his sons. And they're the only ones that are successful. They worked their way through college, they provided, they're married, they've got stable homes, they're not on drugs, they're not messed up. There's something about that. I don't know how he got off on this tangent about father and sons, but the point is this. When Jacob came there and he saw Joseph, and Joseph saw his father, and just the reunion, what happens here, verse 30? Look at how important this is. This is why this is an important thing, how you raise your children, how you impart to them, because this is so important to us. It says, Israel said to Joseph, now listen to what he says. This is going to sound really weird. Verse 30. He goes, now you probably wouldn't say this in a moment of excitement, but this is what he says. Now let me die. He says, now let me die since I have seen your face because you are still alive. Sounds kind of weird, but listen, back in those days, in fact, in the ancient Greek Olympic Games, in one of the original Olympic Games, there was a story of a man who had three sons who each won a different event in the Olympics. Unheard of. Unprecedented. When they won, each of the sons took their wreath and they came over to their father and they placed it on their father's head. The spectators were so overwhelmed at this display of honor that they cried out, die now! Die at once! Of course, that sounds strange. But what they were saying is that you'll never die in a happier moment than this. It will not get any better than this. So this is where you want to just seal it right there. But that's just an expression. Of course, they don't really mean die. But in this case, the guy, according to the story, was so overwhelmed by emotion, he had a heart attack and he died on the spot. But the whole point is this. It is one of those, like, it can't get any better. And this is how it is. When you see your children make those good choices and they become successful and they do well, you are just elated. Then Joseph, verse 31, said to his brothers and to his father's household, I will go up and tell Pharaoh and say to him, my brothers and those of my father's house who were in the land of Canaan have come to me. And the men are shepherds, for their occupation has been to feed livestock. And they've brought their flocks, their herds, and all they have. So it will be when Pharaoh calls you and says, what's your occupation? That you shall say, your servant's occupation has been with livestock from our youth, even till now, both we and also our fathers, that you may dwell in the land of Goshen, for every shepherd is an abomination to the Egyptians. Now, this is an interesting thing. Jacob has built an altar. He's got the answer from the Lord. He arose and went from Beersheba. He's on his direction to pilgrimage. He's taking the 70. And now they come to what I would call here, they're all together. Now they've come, and there's going to be an interesting thing here. They are discovering that they're not going to really fit in with the Egyptians very well. Joseph knows this. And interesting about Joseph, if you really pin this down, one thing I love about Joseph, he's a politician, but he's not a mere politician, he's really a statesman. But he's very shrewd, and yet, and though that in our culture, politicians rank among the lowest people that people trust, the bottom 10% of who people trust is politicians. I always tell my little politician joke about the busload that we're driving down the street. You remember that? And a busload of politicians driving down the street, and they swerve to miss this cow, and they hit a tree, and there are bodies everywhere after the crash. And a farmer comes over and sees all these bodies all everywhere, and he thought the only decent thing was to bury them. So he's finishing burying the last one. A sheriff drives up and says, "What happened here?" And he goes, "Well, these politicians swerved to miss my cow Betsy and hit that tree there, and bodies everywhere, so I thought the only decent thing would be to do is bury them." Sheriff says, "They were all dead?" And he goes, "Well, some of them said they weren't, but you know how them politicians lie." This is my all-time favorite politician joke. I'm just waiting for an opportunity to share that in a little more sophisticated crowd. No, I shouldn't. States crowd. Anyway. Listen, Joseph was a politician, but listen, he's the kind of one guy that you'd want. Why? First of all, he's not ashamed of his family. Do you know, when someone goes and makes it big, and they're well represented with themselves and their immediate family with these new people in these powerful places, and then they're where they came from, Hicksville, you know, their pop comes and talks with a thick accent and doesn't understand the customs and manners of the state. You know, a man would tend to be embarrassed, not Joseph. He's not ashamed of his father at all. A couple reasons for that we'll see Jacob understands. But also Joseph, he arranges a reception with his shepherd hick father, if you will, the way the Egyptians would look at him, with the most powerful man in the world. Now, yeah, granted, only because of who Joseph was would Pharaoh agree to this, but this was a huge reception. He arranges for his family to get the best of the land. How he does it is pretty shrewd. A couple of reasons. One, he kind of convinces the Egyptians, yeah, they're shepherds. You want to keep them a distance. But he's doing this for a purpose, because that is the danger about being in Egypt, living too close. You're in the world, but you don't want to be of it. And he's concerned for his family. Give them a little space. Let them grow as a family. He knows how different they are, and he doesn't want them to be corrupt by the Egyptian life. But he's at complete ease with who he is. And he presents five of his brothers to the Egyptian Pharaoh. And essentially, that's what's going to happen. He's going to present his brothers. In the next chapter, we're going to see what this abomination to them turns out to be a blessing. Listen, chapter 47, we're only going to look at the first 10 verses here to tie this in. But this is all part of that pilgrimage that you and I are on as well. Joseph went and told Pharaoh and said, "My father and my brothers, their flocks and their herds and all that they possess have come from the land of Canaan. And indeed, they are in the land of Goshen." And he took five men from among his brothers and presented them to Pharaoh. He had his own fave five. And Pharaoh said to his brothers, "What is your occupation?" And they said to Pharaoh, "Your servants are shepherds, both we and also our fathers." And they said to Pharaoh, "We have come to dwell in the land because your servants have no pasture for their flocks, for the famine is severe in the land of Canaan. Now therefore, please let your servants dwell in the land of Goshen." And Pharaoh then spoke to Joseph, saying, "Your father and your brothers have come to you. The land of Egypt is before you. Have your father and your brothers dwell in the best of the land. Let them dwell in the land of Goshen. And if you know any competent men among them, then make them chief herdsmen over my livestock." So how Joseph arranges that is quite amazing. You know, he's basically giving both parties what they want. The Egyptians are happy to have them far away, even if they're in the best of the land, and Israel will be safe and they'll have plenty for their cattle. Then we have an interesting encounter. And I would submit to you, the encounter that Jacob has in meeting Pharaoh is both very odd, but it also represents something much deeper. You might be surprised how this applies to you in a very real way. Because we are living in Egypt of sorts. We are on a pilgrimage. We are in a position that we have a great, glorious position with the Lord, but we're called on our journey through this world until finally we come to our home. When we finally cross that final river, if you will, and we're with the Lord. How do we live in Egypt? How do we respond to the people in Egypt? What are we supposed to be? Now, for all appearances' sake, here is the most powerful, wealthy man in the world meeting a hick farmer, Okay? This is what it looks like. Notice what happens. Verse 7, it says, Joseph brought in his father Jacob and set him before Pharaoh. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Pharaoh said to Jacob, how old are you? Jacob said to Pharaoh, I think the reason he asked the question is because when Jacob blesses him, you got to understand, in that culture, in fact, it's even written in Hebrews chapter 7, when Melchizedek blesses Abraham, the point is the greater blesses the lesser, not the other way around. The greater blesses the lesser. Melchizedek blessed Abraham because he was greater, and Jesus is a priest according to the order of Melchizedek, so he's greater than Abraham. That's how Jesus could claim he was greater than Abraham, even though he came from Abraham's loins. It would not work that way except were it not that God was his father. Well, Pharaoh should be the one blessing Jacob, right? Isn't he greater? It would appear that way. So he asks, well, how old are you? It's kind of like, you know, you should be blessing me. How old are you? And of course he says, look, the days of the years of my pilgrimage are 130 years. Few and evil have been the days of the years of my life, and they have not attained to the days of the years of the life of my fathers and the days of their pilgrimage. Do you see how he looks at his life? This is a pilgrimage. This is just passing through. This is not my real home. He's not just referring to the fact that he's in Egypt and he's not back at home in Canaan, because even in Canaan, Abraham dwelt in tents. He knew there was something better. There's something deep in the heart of all of us that we know. There's something more. There has to be. I think C.S. Lewis puts it very well in Mere Christianity, and this is really what struck me as a young man, trying to find my purpose in life and figure out how this could be all true about Jesus and God. There was an interesting point. He says, you know, a fish never thinks of itself as wet. Does a fish even think about being wet? No, because a fish is a fish. It lives in the environment. It doesn't think about being wet. But why is it that we think very much about life in our environment and how we are and the purpose in life and meaning and were we created? What is our reason for being here? It's because there's something deeper. We are not fully at home here. There's something missing. Because we were born in sin, we've not really got a full grasp of the true eternal value of things until the Lord gets our heart and we become born again. Then the kingdom of God is in our midst, but we're blinded to it, just like an unborn child is centimeters away from the outside world, but is oblivious to it. And then when that child is born, all of a sudden his eyes are opened. And in a way, then you begin to see, oh, okay, so this life isn't my home. That makes sense now. That's why this world doesn't satisfy me. That's why all the things I've accumulated in myself, there's a bigger emptiness. Because this is not my home. I'm passing through. So he's got a pilgrimage here, and he tells Pharaoh, look, few and evil have been the days of my life. You know, of course, he's maybe talking about some of the pain that he's gone through, but I think he's just talking about life in general. There's something always missing. Now don't take this blessing lightly. Pharaoh was the embodiment of the god Ra. And here this hick farmer is blessing him. All right, now let's talk about that for a moment. What does that mean? Look, I think it means that Jacob was not intimidated by all the wealth and splendor and the appearance of Pharaoh's power. Because Jacob considered his treasure greater so that he could feel encouraged to bless Pharaoh. You know, are you intimidated by people of wealth and power? Why? Why should you be? Why should you be intimidated if you were going to the grocery store and you just happened to notice the guy next to you is worth a couple $100 million? Do you act differently around? Oh, wow. Ooh, he's important, you know. Why? Do you not believe the truth about yourself? And listen, this betrays us. This betrays us. Because in our heart of hearts, we're kind of hoping that maybe some rich uncle will die and leave us something. In our heart of hearts, we're hoping that we'll have some windfall, some great investment, and all of a sudden we'll become wealthy. And because that's what we're treasuring. And that's the sad picture of our lives here. We're treasuring the wrong things. Jacob had it right. He's blessing Pharaoh. What are you treasuring? More than that, it's not just what you're treasuring, but he's testifying to Pharaoh as well what he treasures. By blessing Pharaoh, he is acknowledging, listen, Pharaoh, all the wealth and all the luxury and all the power you have is nothing compared to what I've got. Do you believe that? So that you would be totally comfortable around somebody that's worth $500 million or $1 billion, it wouldn't faze you at all, because you would see an opportunity, listen, not to be blessed by him instead of like the normal person would think, ooh, I wonder if I can get something from them. Rather, and that's what, you know, rich people are always worried about, right? I mean, think about it. When you have a lot, you're always thinking people want something from you. And sadly, you're right. It's true. Most people do. So you have to live kind of sheltered. You have to be very careful who you're around and what you say and how you drop dimes about stuff, because then they might be intimidated by that. But listen, to a true believer, instead of being intimidated, you ought to be that much more eager to be a blessing to them, because you really believe the truth about yourself. We need to remind ourselves of eternity. We need to testify to people around us what is our priority. Listen, as a parent, you need to testify to your children. What's most important? What do you testify to your kids? Do you know you do? Silently every day, you testify to your kids who you really are, what's most important to you. Not by just what you say, but what you do, what you treasure. Think about what example you're leaving for your kids. It's wonderful you're here this morning. You've taken your family to church. Some of you listening on the internet because it was raining, shame on you. If that was the only reason. I mean, it's funny, when it's really sunny and beautiful, people go, oh, it's so nice, I don't want to go to church. When it's really rainy, oh, it's miserable, I don't want to go to church. It's like you always find an excuse to... But all that is just telling your children what's priority to you. Because if you had tickets to the game, rain or shine, baby, got tickets. Listen, when you take your children out, as a parent, you know, you want to spend time with your children. You know that. You hear that all the time, the priority of that, and that's wonderful. But it's only half true. They need to spend time with you. But like it or not, they are watching you. They are learning from you. What makes you tick? What makes you excited? What gets you excited? How excited you get about a particular show on TV and how excited you are to go to church. They see and they can compare what's important. You're imprinting in their souls, in their hearts, what is most important. I'm always reminded of something that Gail Irwin says. You know, he says he wanted to teach his children good table manners. He says, but the problem is they ended up eating like him. And that's always going to be the problem. We can have all these things we want to impart to our kids, but listen, unless we're living it. Listen, do you take your children to the nursing home down the street and visit the old people and encourage them? I'll tell you, old people love to see kids. And that'll send such a message to your children. These people are souls. These people are important. They're more important than going to the movie right now or going to play ball. Let's do this. Do you take your kids to Broken Loaves and watch the stock the food there? And then they teach the kids, you know, we give this food to people that can't afford it. And it's a blessing to them. And we tell them about what's even more important than just food is the bread of life. You impart to your kids. Do you take the time to help the needy? Do you go on a missions trip because you have a concern? Or if you can't go, do you support it? You let your kids know, look, we're putting aside some money here in this little jar. We're going to help the missionaries. See, these are things you can lay as a foundation for your children, because you will be just like Jacob, testifying to Pharaoh by blessing him. How does this hick farmer bless Pharaoh? Because Pharaoh is lacking something very important. God has shown honor to Pharaoh just by granting Joseph to him, because Joseph is essentially saving the whole nation. Pharaoh's got to remember that. He's got to know who he is. This world is not your home. When are you going to realize what you have, the treasure you have? The Bible says the treasure, we have this treasure in earthen vessels, that the power may not be of us, but of God. We have a far greater treasure. The Bible says all treasures of wisdom and knowledge are hidden in Christ. We have that treasure to share to the world. Yet we're still fiddling around with trinkets. We're playing marbles with diamonds. We're missing it. if we don't understand this point. How do we get to that point of understanding this truly? Sometimes we just have to look at life. We have to tell ourselves that. When I go into the store, I have the same, you know, oh man, that'd be really cool if I get that. It'd make my life easier. Oh, it'd be fun. You know, there's always stuff that you think is going to be the thing. And you have to keep reminding yourself, I don't need that, I don't need that, I don't need that, I don't need that. But the more you window shop and the more you go through the magazines, the more needs you have in your mind that you think you need, it accumulates until you finally, advertisers know if you see an ad 30 times, you're going to just go out and buy it. You're going to make a mental note and you're going to get it. And they just get in the ad in front of you, get in the ad in front of you. And we are so susceptible to what is there in appearance. And we need to have a greater understanding of faith. Now they are richly provided for. It's an interesting illustration. James Montgomery Boyce, in his commentary, records an incident that Alexander Solzhenitsyn shared about his experience 11 years in the Soviet prison system. And he said this, because it was a horrible system. You were interrogated, you were beaten, they broke you in any way they could. He said, this is the only way to survive it. And I would submit to you, in a way, there's an application in the only way to survive going through Egypt. Listen to what he says about this. He says, from the moment you go to prison, you must put your cozy family firmly past behind you. At the very threshold, you must say to yourself, my life is over. A little early to be sure, but there's nothing I can do about it. I shall never return to freedom. I'm condemned to die. And he says, I no longer have any property whatsoever for me. Those whom I loved have died, and I have died to them. From today, my body is useless and alien to me. Only my spirit and my conscience remain precious and valuable to me. Confronted by such a prisoner, the interrogator will tremble. Only the man who has renounced everything can win that victory. Pretty powerful. And it reminds me, too, of the only way I'm going to ever overcome this sojourn through Egypt, to understand what is truly valuable, is to not listen to the dictates of my flesh, my lusts, my desires, which lie to me daily. Every minute they lie to me. They tell me, oh, if you only had that, if only that, if only that. We live in the if-only world. And it's a lie. It's an illusion. Because we already have a treasure that's immeasurable. And when we decide to now be a blessing to others, wow, you find your life. Jesus said, you hold your life, you're going to lose it. But if you give your life away, if you give your life up for my name's sake, you'll find it again.